Okay, continuing on January 20th with Terry Conger. Yeah, you were just saying they could take these big heavy blocks and put them in the pit.
And as each layer were laid down, then just put, cover it with rock, because the rock, we got tremendous rock dumps there. And then these cars, instead of going back for another, going back empty for another load, could take aggregate back in to these terminals. So on one side of the terminal, you'd have garbage stacked up in these compressed blocks, and on the other side, you have piles of rock, sand, and gravel, so that you'd never have a deadhead. Mm-hmm. Now, that could work out beautifully. There are many problems with getting permitted to dump the garbage out there, and so far that hasn't happened. But that certainly is a possibility, and someday it may.
I can envision that then the next step would be when metal becomes so scarce that they go back and mine that garbage for the metal that's in it.
Well, that could be. That could be. We've seen it happen, haven't we, in our own business, where tailings piles become valuable again.
Garbage might become valuable again.
Yeah, so it probably will. So anyhow, that pretty much was, I think, the CalMat story.
You're not still on that.
No, because that board went away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the third company you have there is ASA Limited, which stands for American South African Limited. This is a company that was founded back in 1958 by what would now be called a venture capitalist named Charles Engelhardt. And he was a doer and a thinker back in New York, a very, very active, innovative guy.
There's an Engelhardt Price.
Engelhardt prices metals, silver and gold, yeah.
Price is still quoted.
And they got into a lot of other minerals businesses as well, Engelhardt did. But anyhow, Charlie went to South Africa early on in his career and just fell in love with the country. And so this is, just 10 years after the war or so. And so he saw the opportunity to allow people in the U.S. to invest in South Africa, those people that would be interested in gold, having gold investments, by establishing a South African company and registering that company on the New York Stock Exchange, so that people in this country could buy ASA stock and own a portfolio of South African gold mining companies. And so he got the South African government to issue him a franchise to do this. It took special legislation for this company to do this. And some of the things that had to happen to make it viable was that the company, ASA, could repatriate its dividends to its U.S. shareholders, and those dividends couldn't be withheld, nor should they pay taxes in South Africa. So he was able to get that legislation passed, and then subsequently he was able to list the company on the New York Stock Exchange. So he funded it with $25 million. Back in 1958, and so by 1980, at the zenith of the gold market, gold got to $850 early in 1980, that $58 million or $28 million investment had grown to $1 billion and paid dividends all through this period of time at the same ratio that the South African gold stocks were paying dividends, which are the highest gold paying dividends in the world and are to, even today. So it was a tremendously successful company, vehicle for people in this country to invest in a portfolio of South African gold stocks. Now, as now with the gold price where it is, company's street or market value has dropped from that $1 billion in 1980, and I think it's around 250 to 300 million now, something like that, because of the gold price. But also, it's taken it, the effect of apartheid and the uncertainty with how South African investments are going to fare through this readjustment. The stock price has dropped to that extent. But this is a company that meets quarterly.
When were you invited on the board?
I think I went on the board in 86.
How did that come about?
There were a couple of fellows on the board that, one of whom knew Dick Storr. And Dick introduced me to both of them. They were both investment bankers with Dylan Reed. And at that time, they were both on the board of ASA. John Haskell and Robert Pilkington. In any case, they asked me to join the board, those two people, after we'd met.
Where did you meet them?
Well, I don't, probably in San Francisco, but I don't just recall the first time we met, but it most likely was in San Francisco. The benefit I saw in being on that board was to know more about and keep in touch with the gold mining in South Africa, which to this day is still the largest gold producing area in the world. So I felt that that large contribution to the world's production of gold would continue to be a very strong force in what happens in the gold market. And so I thought that would be a good opportunity for me to learn more about that, to help with my thinking about what Homestake should be doing and how we go about our business. I never anticipated that would lead to Homestake investing in South Africa, because as I learned more and more about South Africa, I realized that the mining houses in South Africa have such a hold on that district, that mining district that has produced all these millions and millions of ounces of gold, that'd be difficult, if not impossible, to compete with them down there. And it would be big stakes to compete with them, because those mines are so deep and takes many, many hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a new mine there because of the depth. Plus the social problems that were at risk.
Was there pressure for Homestake to go in?
No. We had Homestake for the longest time has enjoyed a good relationship with the South African mining companies, because mm-hmm. we had a lot of similar opportunities and problems with our deep mines, ours in Lead and theirs in South Africa. And ours in Lead was older than theirs. Those mines weren't really discovered to the mid-1890s. And of course, Homestake mine was 1875, so mm-hmm. we were sort of a leg up on them And we got deep almost as fast as they did. So there's a lot of technology transfer and sharing of information back and forth between the Chamber of Mines, which was the organization that those gold mines formed to do a lot of their research and development, and also do their labor contracts and so forth to bring in outside labor into the country to work in a gold mine. We exchanged a lot of information with these people on refrigeration of air. That was one of the things that we worked on together. Ventilation at deep mines, ground pressure. Happily, ours was nowhere near what theirs is. So we didn't and don't experience the same kind of seismic events that they have in South Africa. But just a lot of information.
That autoclaving technology.
And autoclaving, that's right. Did that for our uranium initially, and then at McLaughlin, yeah. So there's a lot of home stake to South African interchange. And high respect for one another, but never really talked about doing anything over there. I remember when I hadn't been with the company very long, and Don McLaughlin introduced me to the then president of the Chamber of Mines, which was a paid position, and I think his name was Angus McCauley. Anyhow, we all went to lunch together, and I could see the warm relationship between Don and Angus, and it comes from mutual respect, but also from familiarity. Those two knew each other very well, and so that sort of early on sort of gave me the sense that these are people that you really do want to know, because they do the kinds of things we do, and they've done very well at doing it. So that was an early tip to me that I want to build my own relationships with people in South Africa for the same reason. And it's turned out to be very, very helpful and valuable. And I think to the company, you know, to continue that. So that directorship will go on for some period of time.
That's meant for some interesting travels too.
Yes. Oh, that's a good point. Because we are a South African company, and do no business in the U.S. except hold our annual meeting in the U.S. because that's required by the SEC. We don't meet in the U.S. We meet in Toronto, we meet in Bermuda, we meet in Johannesburg, we meet in London, but we don't meet in the U.S. And I remember one of the early board meetings. We have three South African directors. We have, well, it must have been five U.S. directors and one U.K. director. With the exception of me, all of the others are distinguished people, you know, well known in their country and highly, highly regarded. And so we were at, might have been even my first board meeting, or my first annual meeting. It was in New York, and they're in February. And so we all are in town. We had dinner the night before, getting to know these people a little bit. Very distinguished. I was really impressed and sort of wondering how come I'm here, but it was just fun to see them and be with them. So the next morning, we had the annual meeting in the same hotel where we were all staying. And as soon as the meeting was over, we were to go to LaGuardia and fly up to Toronto to have a board meeting. Mm-hmm. because we did do business in the US. Well, it was snowing blue places all night long. So the next morning, snow was about that deep. And we, nothing was flying. So the chairman got the lawyers on the phone and said, we can't get out of town to have a board meeting. What can we do? And the lawyer said, well, that's a toughie. So then they went into consultation. They called us back. We're all standing in the lobby. We had cars out in front to take us to the airport. The lawyers called back and said, well, we've checked, and we're certain that if you have your board meeting in the South African Embassy on 42nd and 3rd or wherever it was, that'll be okay. So we piled in these cars and we go over to, and it was only about 8 or 9 blocks, but it took us an hour to get there because mm-hmm. snow was in, it just awful. So we pull up in front of this 42nd, as you probably know, over on 3rd, sort of thin, narrow, narrow little streets running east and west. And we get over there, and God, we're just halfway down the block, and traffic's all backed up, and cars are turned sideways and everything. This building, the whole front of it's sheeted up with plywood and stuff, and scaffolding. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, is that the building we're going to? And somebody else said, yeah, I think so. They're rebuilding the embassy. So we all piled out of these cars and walked down the block in the snow into this building that's now all gutted. There's nothing inside because they're redoing it. And so we go around these workmen and everything and go up these wooden stairs that are just sort of homemade for the workmen. And they, for our benefit, they put plywood up over in this corner with one window in it for our room. And they had a plywood sheet for the table. And we'd sat on boxes and stuff around this table. And we could just barely get in there and get around this. And I'm sitting there, I'm looking around at these guys, and I'm thinking, I can't believe this. I can't believe there are all these guys sitting around this table.
Oh.
You know, they come from very good circumstances, all of them, either at home or at work. And here we're sitting around this table. And so the chairman said, okay, now we got to listen to this. I've had the lawyers come over here and explain to us what we can do and what we can't do here. Mm-hmm. So here are four, had to be high-priced lawyers. They couldn't get in the room. They're standing out in the hall. And each one, when they said something, they'd stick his head in there and he'd read off his paper to us. And then he'd step back and the other guy would step in and he'd read off his paper to us.
Oh.
And I thought, my God, what have I gotten myself into here? This is the hardest thing I've ever seen.
Oh.
But anyhow, that was sort of my introduction into this this business that we couldn't do business in the U.S. because we didn't want to create a taxable event, you know. And so, as you pointed out, it's been great in that we meet in some of the neatest places you can imagine. And so that has turned out to be fun.
How often do they meet?
They meet quarterly, and our fund, it's a closed-end fund, has the lowest overhead cost of any of the mutual funds, closed end or open end, year after year after year. So we're all proud of that. Very little overhead for this. They don't pay us much, but the fun is to be with those people and to get to go to South Africa every year. And that more than makes up for what we're paid to do that. So that's been fun. And our chairman, Wes Stanger, wonderful. Wesley Stanger, S-T-A-N-G-E-R, used to be an investment banker with Mackay Shields. Old Line Investment House in New York for years and years, one of the top group in the city. But Wes is just one of the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life. And so that's been a great joy to be associated with he and his wife, Natalie. Wes stepped down as chairman at 89. Mm. And so now our chairman is Bob Irwin, who is 70, he's only 72. So we've moved our average age down quite a bit. Wes is no longer on the board. He's chairman emeritus of the company, but not on the board.
So they have no age limit.
No age limit. Mm-hmm. And another director that just stepped down with Wes at the same time is Reg Jones, who was the former chairman of General Electric. Mm-hmm. And he just elected to stand down from the board. So he's been a great contributor to the company and a wonderful person to get to know over these years. So as you say, no age limit on that, so I'm looking forward to continuing that for some period of time.
That's more good trips.
Yeah, more good trips and opportunity to follow something that has been of great interest to me for many years. Mm-hmm. That's the South African situation, mm-hmm. both the mining and social. Mm-hmm. Situation. Let's see, and I guess the other one is probably Baker Hughes, which is an oil services company that at the time I joined the board was headquartered in Irvine, California. It was the Baker Tool Company at that time, but by the time, that was in 87, by the time I joined the board, they had just acquired Hughes Tool Company, and that formed the company now called Baker Hughes. I did not know anybody, well, that isn't true. I knew two people that were on the board at Baker Hughes, but I didn't know anybody in management. They have probably some of the best corporate governance rules of any of the companies I've been associated with. And one of them was how they pick their directors. Every year, they send out a questionnaire to the board asking them to fill out what strengths we thought each of us had, ourselves and the others. We said we thought what the others had. And so then based on that, when it was time to replace a director, the chairman would look at the responses to those questionnaires, and from that would determine what the board really needed. We're weak in this area, we're weak in that area, we could use some new thoughts in this area, kind of thing. So based on that, then they'd write a description of what they wanted their new director to look like. And they'd give it to a headhunter and just wait for them to bring people back that supposedly looked like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's how my name came up in the thing. They needed wanted somebody that was in the mining business, because the Baker company had the old IMCO, the old IMCO company that we all know and love, mm-hmm. Salt Lake City, Burnt Chapman, all of that. So they had that line of business, and it's a very profitable line of business for them. So they felt they wanted somebody in the mining industry, in the hard rock mining industry, on the board, because they had a coal miner CEO on the board, Bob Quinnen, who was running Peabody. And that's one of the people that I knew that was on the board. And so anyhow, that's how I was selected. And I was contacted by them, and I thought, well, you know, I really shouldn't take the time to do this. So I told them that I just didn't think I had time to do that. But then the chairman got Bob Quinnen and I'm trying to think of the other guy that used to run a small company called Earth Resources. Anyhow, he was on their board. He was an oil and gas guy, but they had a mine up in Idaho. And so I knew this guy through that mine, because we've talked to them several times. And his name's escaping me right now. But anyhow, the chairman and Bob Quinnen and this other fellow all hopped on the airplane, came out to San Francisco and put the full court press on me to reconsider and join the board. And I liked what I heard, you know, what kinds of things they were doing, the company. And so I talked to my board. We agreed that was the right thing to do. So that's how I got on that board. One of the other corporate governance rules of theirs is that you only serve 10 years or age 70, whichever comes first. So I joined in 87, and so in 97 I had served my 10 years, so I went off that board 2 years ago. But enjoyed that very much. That was really my first experience with people that were in the manufacturing business, actually made things, and had to go out and market them. And because they made things that our company bought, I found that very useful to know. And also I was able to tell the manufacturers and marketers what the industry people look for. So that was a pretty good exchange of ideas both ways, to have a better understanding of how companies try to anticipate what users are going to want and need, and how they then are able to take in information that helps them produce stuff that will be more readily purchased. So that was an interesting 10 years, and I think I took to them and brought from them information that made that worthwhile. So that was a good association. And then the last board that we talked about in public companies was this small startup company called Apex Silver, that I just joined in 97, I guess it was, before they were a company. I had been contacted by a consulting group that had done work for them. And the consulting group had suggested to the fellow that started this company up that perhaps I could help them in sort of organizing the company and the plans that they envisioned. And I met the young guy that started the company, and that
who was that?
His name is Tom Copeland, or Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N, Tom Kaplan. So I joined him and his small group then, because they didn't even have an operating guy. Tom is a financier and a commodities specialist, and so he didn't have any operating people at that point. He hired a guy named Keith Hulley, who had been the chief operating guy for Western Mining over in Australia, and who was a first-rate administrator and operator. And Tom was very lucky to get him to come on board. And because of that, because he was able to hire somebody like Keith, I thought that I would like to keep my association with them up. And so when they took the company public, I agreed to go on the board. And it's a very interesting board that Tom Kaplan has assembled. There's only one, two, three of us that are US citizens. There's an Argentinian on the board, there's a Cayman Island person on the board, there's a UK resident on the board, there's a Belgian resident on the board, and there's a Norwegian on the board.
Wow.
Very interesting cross-section of people.
Yeah.
One of the other two, or the other, yeah, the other two US directors is a gentleman named Paul Soros, whose brother George is known around the world. Paul is a very interesting guy. He's a mechanical engineer himself, has had several engineering companies of his own, specialized in harbor construction for bulk loading terminals and so forth. And so Paul had worked on jobs that I was quite familiar with in South America and on the West Coast. So that's been a fun association.
Where do they meet?
Generally in New York, but we've met in Caracas, and we've met in London. I guess that those. No, we've met in Toronto as well, and New York. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of around, depending on where we are. And the company has a very large low-grade silver zinc deposit in Bolivia. And I've been down to see the prospect during the early drilling stages, and that drilling has proven up a very large reserve that has allowed the company to complete a feasibility study that's bankable, which means that with that study they can now get funding to develop the project. That'll probably cost nearly $300 million to develop the mine, but that's going ahead right now, and so that's going to be a fun thing to work with the company in development of this property. We've not set. We've just been in the process. Paul Soros and I are on the compensation committee, and we've been sort of setting the corporate rules up for the company. And we've not, since he's over 70 and I'm about to be 70, we have not set any age limits at this point. So it's.
So you just said that it's not certain.
It's not certain how,
yeah.
You know, whether
okay.
Paul and I will finally shoulder up to the responsibility of
kicking
legislating ourselves out of off the board.
But I
would think that there'll be several years before we come to that point. Setting that.
Yeah. I think you maybe just about finished, I guess, with
I did.
Silver mine,
mm-hmm.
Apex silver mines.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted you to comment a little bit on your thoughts on two things, inside directors
mm-hmm.
and directors as major stockholders or stockholders at all, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, and
I think
two.
Those are topics that are being discussed a good deal now. And also, if you have any thoughts on ratio of compensation to workers' wages.
Okay, let's just take those and you keep me
okay.
Thinking about those three items. But starting with the first one on
as to inside and outside directors. I have always felt that the board ought to be made up predominantly of outside directors, and have personally kept it as far as what I could control at Homestake. I had two executive vice presidents on the board, but I never increased that number of inside directors after that. And so
why?
Because I think it's appropriate that you have a predominant number of outside directors on the board, so that management can't unduly influence the board's judgment on things. Some companies have a majority of insiders on the board, so you know the situation is one in which all of the other insiders are going to have to be mute on a subject that has been decided by management collectively and presented by the chairman or the CEO. That's the way it is. You, the insider, had a chance at our management meeting to have all your say on the issue, and if you were against whatever it is, but we've decided to take it to the board anyhow, you don't get another bite at the apple. You just sit there, because you had your chance to convince us that it wasn't the right thing to do. You couldn't convince us we're doing it. Now just sit there and let the outside directors decide what to do. And people argue forever that no, that's not the way it is, but that is the way it is. That is the way it is. So that's why you should have a majority of the people on the board as outside directors. So we've had, during my time, we had Bill and Jim and myself, and then Jim left shortly after Dave Fagan came. Dave went on the board, Jim left, was not on the board. Then Dave left, but Peter Steen came and was on the board. So just about all of my tenure, I had three inside directors on a 12 to 13 man board. So I felt that that was appropriate, obviously. But it allowed the outside directors to dictate what we would do.
They had the control.
They had the control. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. I did. Mm-hmm. So I think that's appropriate. The second thing you mentioned is to what extent senior management should be shareholders, be owners. That's gotten a lot of attention in the last 10 years. I always felt, before it became popular, to set criteria for ownership, I always felt it was incumbent upon senior management to own as much of the company's shares as they could. And I justified that personally by saying, well, how many of us get a chance to actually run something? In my case, the CEO, I get to run it, so why wouldn't I invest in it? I don't run anything else I could invest in, so why wouldn't it be a good investment? Well, through the years, I've had a lot of advice saying, you dumb bunny, you don't have everything in one company, whether you're on it or not. But I felt that it was my job to own as much of Homestake stock as I could, and so I bought as much as I could. And unhappily for me, I've seen it decrease in value dramatically. But that's, you know, that was just part of the deal. And I didn't feel I could sell when I could have sold. When I first stepped down as CEO, I could have sold for 3 times what I could sell now. I didn't do it because I was still chairman. And so now it's dropped down to a third of what it was. But anyhow, that's part of the game, I think. And certainly the person that runs a company ought to have a large stake in the company. And so I took virtually all the money I made and put it in Homestake stock in the years I was there. And there was a time it was worth a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's worth a third of that.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, that's.
Do you think that, apart from your personal, but if, would a director's decisions be influenced by the fact that.
No.
They were also a big stockholder?
No, I don't think so. No.
I would think they might be positively influenced. They'd want the company to succeed.
Oh yeah, but
for
you want
own,
that anyhow.
For their own.
Yeah, for your money,
but
you want that. You want that anyhow. I don't know of a person that we had on our board that would have said, no, "I don't care. Let's take a chance on this." Because I won't lose anything.
Mm-hmm.
All the directors we've had, I can't think of one that would have, to himself, thought that I won't lose anything, so let's try.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thought. So while it sounds right, I don't think that is as much a motivator as people would say it is. And you know, they've been trying, the SEC, CalPERS, all these various groups have been trying to find ways to make the director think exactly like a shareholder. And all of the things they've come up with, not all of them, a lot of them, keep backfiring, such as a third of management's compensation ought to be pay, and two-thirds ought to be at risk. In other words, if the company does well, they do well. If the company doesn't do well, they don't get anything. That's fair. Well, so, you know, they've been driving towards that. Companies have been giving restricted stock and huge stock options and all this kind of stuff. And the Michael Eisners in the world, all of a sudden they're making $200-300 million a year on their stock options. Wait a minute. We didn't expect that. But that's, you know, your markets go up and down, and if you hit it just right, and so there is no answer to any of this stuff. You know, you can't legislate morals and ethics. You can't do it. The way you legislate is try to pick people that you think have those.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, if you're lucky enough, you have them, and you surround yourself with people that have them. That's the only insurance there is.
That's ultimately what it comes down to,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, you can't legislate this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you try to, a set of circumstances arises that it works out differently than they anticipated. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden somebody's making a huge amount of money. Well, it's just what they had planned that the shareholders were going to do. Well, they did. They didn't think this guy was going to make so much money. But the way they set it up, he did. Mm-hmm. Now he could have made nothing, too. But at any given period of time, things work right, and you make a lot. So I put all of my money into Homestake shares because I felt it was the right thing to do, and I believed in the company, and I wanted other people to know that I did, not just our directors, but our shareholders. I liked looking at that proxy statement every year and seeing my shareholding there. I was proud of that. I was pleased with it. And I'm still proud of it. So that's my personal feel. People that would like to manage money for me say I'm stupid, mm-hmm. and as it turns out, I have a lot less money for having done. But yeah, so. Yeah. So,
now, are you an investor in these other companies, though, that you're a director
of? Yeah, yes. You've
also invested in them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I've taken all of my dividends from PG&E and bought stock with them since I joined the company.
All of your compensation.
No dividends, not my compensation. No, I took my compensation, but my dividends and being utility, it's a high yielding stock, mm-hmm. so that's amounted to a sizable sum of money. You know, the stock that I bought initially, plus my dividends, I have almost 10,000 shares. Well, I have over 10,000 shares, as a matter of fact, of the stock. So yeah, I'm, you know, that's worth $250,000-$300,000 in today's market. So, you know, sizable sum. And the same with the other companies. I had over 100,000 in each of the other companies as well.
So you put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, yeah. Again, for the same reason that you know, if you're gonna invest time in this, you need to show that you think that it's worth investing in. Why would other people invest in it? Yeah. Okay, then you ask the real ringer about the wage gap. And the wage gap, you know, it's expressed in a lot of different ways, depending on who you're talking about. Because just in the paper yesterday, I read that in this tremendous economy, the rich are still getting richer and the poor are just barely getting richer. And I guess it's always going to be that way. I don't see how the social engineering that we've done so far is going to change that. Now, so that's going to continue. There's always going to be some people getting a lot more than other people. And depending on where you are on that scale, says what you think's a lot more. And the further down the scale you are, the lower down a lot more is. And the higher up you get, a lot more is a lot more. So, you know, that's never going to change. Most people don't think they get enough, but somebody else gets too much. Never will solve that problem. In a company where you got guys in the mine actually producing what it is you make your money on.
And risking their lives.
Versus somebody sitting in San Francisco, making, and I don't know what their ratio is, but it was tremendous, whatever it was. there's no way to socially justify that. If you're gonna try to do it on equality, you've got to define equality, and no two people will define that the same way, because that person in the mine risking his life doesn't have the same set of risks that I do or Jack does in running the company. And so to compensate for that, only the marketplace can do that, or should do it. If the government tries to do it, we know that won't work. So I guess where I come down on that is that because of the marketplace driving what happens at the top end, and lately even more than on the bottom end, because labor unions and other forces that drive the hourly wage up have been muted by several factors. That would account for one of the reasons that the gap has gotten bigger. I think the other reason is that there is some ability of management to get advice on what competitive wages are and then use that internally. It's available. You can read what other people are getting in comparable jobs, and therefore you can justify, gee, if they're getting that, I'm doing the same thing they are, I should get that too. So, you know, there's always that opportunity to use that information to better yourself. I tried to see that all of we senior people at the company were never getting more than our peers were, that we were
in other comparable companies,
in our mining companies, mm-hmm. Yeah, doing the same kind of work we were doing. I never wanted us to be seen as being out front on salaries and bonuses and stock options and all of that, and we weren't. As a matter of fact, when Jack came in, and this is the right thing to do, he had consultants come in and look at the pay structure and everything, and they came back and said, you guys aren't competitive. These other companies are doing a lot more for their senior executives than you guys are. And so Jack did a new program and took it to the board. So that sort of made me feel good, because I didn't want to be out in front. I didn't think that was right. But I still was making a lot more money than the guy in lead, risking his life. So how you justify that, or defend it, or should you justify it? The guy that runs a company ought to get paid one thing, sort of irrespective of what the guy down the mine gets, because they aren't directly connected, just because they work for the same company, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a hot topic right now.
Yeah.
And more so in other industries than in mining, I think.
Only because mining's down now.
Yeah, you know, but you don't see those enormously high.
Well, in mining, I don't think you ever did. You know, most of us work for wages one way or another. We're not owners. So we work for wages. So at any rate, that's the hot topic, has been for 4 or 5 years. It'll fade and something else will become a hot topic. You'll try to correct that and something else will fall out of that that's totally unintended.
Unintended consequences.
Yeah. How did this happen? Yeah, so.
Well, let's talk then about some of the things that you did, not directorships, but your trusteeship at Caltech.
Yes, been at Caltech for about 15 years now as a trustee. The interesting thing about Caltech, first of all, just the opportunity to be on their board is a unique one because it is such a unique institution. 3,000 students, 2/3 of whom are graduate students, 28 Nobel laureates, either active or have been members of the faculty. The current president is a Nobel laureate. Just this year, this past year, the single Nobel Prize awarded in chemistry, and I say single because normally they split that up between two or three deserving recipients every year because there's so much going on in chemistry. This year, last year there was one, and he was a fellow from Caltech, professor at Caltech, and everybody at the institute knew that he was in the running for this. Couldn't believe that he'd be the only recipient, but he was. Neat young Turkish guy, and Rosemary and I met he and his family at the retreat we had this fall, and it was just 2 days before we had a retreat. There was that horrible earthquake. In Turkey, in Istanbul, or just out of Istanbul, where so many thousands were killed. And so we were afraid when we heard that he won, that he had family that was in that terrible earthquake. Happily, he did not. Well, no. There's a plane that went down. The Egyptian, this guy was not a Turk, and he was an Egyptian. And remember the plane that originated in Los Angeles and went to New York and was delayed and then took off and went down off a long angle, Long Island. That was it. And we were afraid, God, maybe he's got family on there because he just won the Nobel Prize and maybe they came over to see him and were going home. Happily he did. So he didn't have any. So that it wasn't here. It was the Egyptian plane went down. And happily none of his family was on there. Anyhow, so it's a unique school by so many standards. And the board is unique. Very, very well-recognized people in all different industries. So it
was. Are they all Californians?
No, they're from all over the country. All over the country. And the board meets twice a year. The executive committee meets every month. So depending on whether you're on the executive committee or not, you're meeting at least twice a year. And if you come, tw- twice a year, one of which is a commencement every May.
Which committees have you been on?
I'm on the...
I'm probably not talking loud enough. Which committees have you been on?
I'm on the, and have been on the Personnel Policies Committee, which is the committee that is like a compensation committee on our public companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I chair that committee. And then I'm on the Investment Committee. This small school has an endowment of $1.3 billion. B.
Mm.
Incredible. Just incredible. So, in any case, one investment committee, which invests $1.3 billion.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
How did you come to be invited?
Two people that were on the board suggested that I do that. One was Howard Vesper, who was a director of Homestake for a long time. And the first person to ever take me up to the Grove at the Bohemian Club, he and Ruth invited Phyllis and I up for a picnic. And of course, I didn't even know what the Bohemian Club was, but we were fascinated to see what the Grove was. So Howard was one of the people. He was a trustee. He was a graduate of Caltech, a vice president, director of Chevron. So he asked me one day if I'd be interested in joining the board of trustees. And I said, yeah, that does sound very interesting. And the other person was Ben Biagini, who was the chairman of Southern Pacific. And Ben had been a trustee for years and years.
How had you known him?
Well, just around the city, up to PU Club and other places. And Ben was very active in the Republican Party, and I was a little bit active, and so we knew he was there, and then at business meetings and stuff around the city. So I'd known Ben, I guess, for quite a long time by this time. And so he and Howard put me up for nomination for the board, and I was elected. And that must have been, I just was elected again this fall, and they're 5-year terms, so that must have been in 84. I've served for about 15 years.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a great association.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen three presidents now.
Mm-hmm. How does that differ from or compare with?
Just like with companies.
Company.
Different, totally different setup. Caltech is a school that has engineers or trains engineers and scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of two sides of the house. And they don't see each other in anything like each other.
No.
The scientists are the people that have conceptual things that they must then demonstrate through the various scientific techniques to establish the theorem, prove it. The engineer takes whatever there is and builds something with it,
mm-hmm.
makes it work, and produce something. So they look at themselves different. And I mention this because that's sort of the way presidents are looked at too. One side of the house isn't as happy when an engineer is running the school as when a scientist is running the school. So we I got in just at the end of Murph Goldberger's tenure, and he was just stepping down when Tom Everhart was appointed as president. Tom's an electrical engineer. So he was an engineer running the school for 10 years. Well, I'd hear grousing from some of the scientists about, God, we got to, how much longer has he got? We got to get a scientist back in. Well, now we've just, 2 years ago, appointed David Baltimore as president. David won his Nobel Prize for his work on genetics and his work on AIDS, and you know how they've sort of tracked down to its basic elements what the heck this sinister virus is. So he's a pure scientist. Mm-hmm. So now we have a scientist running the school. But it's all very interesting to watch this happen. And additionally, and this is probably as much an exposure I get to school as any of it, I chair the visiting committee for the Geology and Planetary Sciences division of the school, which includes seismology and all the geology and all of the other planetary sciences. And so I've worked closely with the head of that division, who's a young guy named Ed Stopler, who's and to get these people to give up their research and their teaching to take on an administrative job is tough, because they don't make their mark in life by being an administrator. No. They make it by research, as you know, and papers and books published and a Nobel Prize along the way if you were lucky enough. Not by being an administrator, running a division, or God forbid, running the whole institute. So it's tough to get good people in the division to take the job. And they usually take it and say, all right, and so they do it for 5 years or something. And then quickly we want to get back into the research. So we're lucky to have this young guy, Ed, running the division now, and he just has agreed to do it for another 5 years. He just finished his 5 years. But he and I work closely together for this 5 years. And
what does the visiting committee, what are your responsibilities?
Well, we visit the division once every 2 or 3 years as a committee. And they give us the dog and pony show. And not just, there's three of we trustees, but then we invite, or the division invites, as part of our committee, very capable, exceptional people in that field from other schools, MIT, Harvard, Cornell, these other schools, other top engineering and scientific schools. They'll pick one or two people from those schools to come be part of our committee. And so then we trustees and these three or four outlanders that know what it is these guys are supposed to be doing come in. And so we spend 2 days or 3 days going around having presentations from the various professors there on their research, their students, what they're trying to do, how they're doing it, and then we fall back after this and write a report and give it to the president. meantime, between these visits, I have been, and the other division chairman do the same thing, I'm sure, in monthly contact with the division head. And usually they're telling us what their issues are right now, what their recruiting objectives are, how many people